This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features the second part of a narration from The Essential Sasanko, a collection of chess portraits and stories authored by chess grandmaster Gena Sasanko. The subject of this week's episode is Latvian chess master and trainer Alexander Koblenz. Koblenz is best known as the trainer of chess legend and former world champion Mikhail Tal, in whose development he played a central part. Enjoy this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast.
Alexander Koblenz, the Maestro, continued. Koblenz's activity was not restricted to working with Tal. He loved chess in all its manifestations. He took part in the creation of the magazine SARS in Latvian and Russian, which had an enormous circulation for a chess magazine of 68,500 copies. He was trainer of the Latvian team and director of the Republic's Chess Club, to say nothing about the large number of books that he wrote. It would be wrong to think that the maestro was some kind of altruist who, while working, forgot about his own interests. Enthusiasm, passion, and energy were combined in him with a practical vein and a pragmatic approach to life. I think that were the maestro to have ended up on an island somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, within a couple of years, the first chess championship would have been held there. Plans would also have been made for a team championship. Junior chess schools would be functioning, as would a higher master school, where the maestro himself would read lectures. A note would have been made of an especially bright lad with coarse, curly hair. The maestro himself would be well in with the main administrator of the island, who would also have been taught to play. Moreover, a small booklet with his first combinations would already be on sale. It would be hard to say what the maestro in fact thought about him. Although he was completely fluent in the local dialect, at his home they preferred to speak Yiddish. In souvenir kiosks, along with placemats with drawings of a chessboard and knight heads, skillfully chiselled by local craftsmen, one would also be able to buy beautifully produced books of the maestro himself, assisting the development of combinative vision. Young trainers, who in their time had been pupils of the maestro, would, it is true, whisper behind his back that his methods were hopelessly outdated and that the maestro's three-story villa directly on the banks of the ocean was a genuine palace. It was even said that the bottom of the fair-sized swimming pool was laid in black and white tiles. Of course, these rumours would reach the maestro, but he would not pay any attention to them. All his time would be spent preparing for the match with the largest island of the archipelago, in which he was confident of victory, and then, who knows, even to the continent it was not so far. We spent 2 weeks together in Moscow in the summer of 1968 at the candidates' semi-final match between Tal and Korshnoi, where the maestro was Tal's trainer and I was his second. In a match which initially went hopelessly, a glimmer of hope suddenly appeared. The battle became more complicated, and the tension fell only with the last move. Chess took up nearly all our time, and now I regret that I did not ask him about much that would be interesting now. On the other hand, the Sasanko of those times had little in common with the author of these lines, apart from having the same name. After I left the country, we regularly exchanged greetings, most often via Tal. And in 1979, I think it was, playing in the Bundesliga and whiling away some time waiting for a train to Amsterdam on the station of some German town, I remembered his smile and, hoping that he would understand who had written it, sent him a postcard with an unsigned message repeating, however, on the other side of it in German, Grüße aus Koblenz. The breakup of the Soviet Union in the late 80s began in the Baltic states. In Latvia, the nationality question was especially critical. Human and professional qualities were pushed into the background. The 400-year-old lore of the Swedish King Gustav II Adolf, brackets, Latvia was then part of the Swedish Empire, close brackets, unexpectedly became topical again. That no Jews and foreigners to the detriment of the citizens of Liflandia should be tolerated. In the late 80s, Koblenz, who had written his first book in the Latvian language more than 50 years earlier, was not given a place in the new chess federation. He took this very much to heart, and he even became ill. He was, by now, over 70. But the maestro still had a childlike longing for gratitude in general, and of public gratitude in particular. He was a passionate man of diverse talents, which in many, more down-to-earth people, provoked a feeling of envy or annoyance. In 1991, Koblenz left Riga, where he'd been born and had lived his entire life, for Germany. German was his language. His son, too, had already been living there for a long time. But this world, without Russias and Latvias, looked different from the one he had known more than 50 years earlier. He did not emigrate in the unconditional meaning of the word, since from time to time the maestro was seen in Riga. I have gathered nearly all the documents confirming the rights of our family to the house, he wrote to me during that time, apart from one about the death of my mother in the ghetto. In the late 80s, we again established contact. There was a frequent exchange of letters and telephone calls, especially after he moved to Berlin. He sent me his latest books, all with warm inscriptions, made in beautiful script. In these books, along with citations of great chess players on various aspects of the game, one comes across the views of Kant, Goethe, and Schopenhauer. His books have been published in many languages, about his work with Thal, a chess primer, about combinations, and finally, a last series of books published in Berlin, Training with Alexander Koblenz. Thal named Koblenz's primer School of Chess among the books that had the most influence on him. I do not think that this was merely a polite compliment to his trainer and mentor. The book is indeed a good one, large format, splendidly published, but most importantly, written with talent and with love. The primers, his trainer's diaries, his psychological searchings and his book of memoirs make interesting reading, in particular because of that warm feeling for chess and for the people linked with the game. Under his pen, any story, even a rather commonplace one, would assume the colours of a Persian fairy tale, and the heroes of the narrative would take on the features of Sinbad the Sailor. Even so, these books relate more to the genre of operetta rather than opera, and do not achieve a very high level, mainly because Koblenz was by nature more of a person of energy and action than contemplation, thought, and analysis. Usually, the maestro would reply to my letters the same day. He wrote in almost conversational language. Well, Genya, I received your letter, and do you know what I have been thinking about? Which would mainly consist of ideas, plans, and projects. This is typical of youth, but even at his 75 years, the maestro was young. Whatever he did, he regarded each of his aims and tasks as a step, and he never sat down to rest on them. He was full of energy, and in everything he radiated joie de vivre. He had the laugh of someone who enjoyed life in a childlike manner, and he loved to be surprised by this life. He retained the same friskiness, that same call to action, to changes, that same dislike of boredom and rest. The very state of rest was completely foreign to him. I think that he unconsciously thought that here on earth there should not be any rest, regarding life as an approach to a goal which could never be fully achieved. His idea to come to Amsterdam for several months was not carried out, yet he talked about it as if the match Aljekin-Jerva was still being played, as if Tartakova was still spreading out his sheets with variations in the press centre, in order to convey them to newspapers throughout the world, as if there was still the possibility of interviewing Lasker, and to Widmar, on meeting him in the foyer, he could say that a life devoted to chess was a success. He spoke about them as of living people, with whom, for some reason, he was deprived of the opportunity for direct contact, a feeling that I now experience with regard to him. In 1991, in Berlin, the first issue of Schack Journal was published, with Koblenz as editor-in-chief, and he himself wrote in it about the training process, the psychology of play. I am afraid that these articles are of interest now only to an historian. Today's chess differs too much from the game that the maestro played in the cafes of London and Madrid, and also from the chess of the USSR championships, won by Tal 40 years ago. The maestro's story of how he accidentally hit upon the variation of the French defence that was communicated to Tal only half an hour before the first game of the World Championship match against Botvinnik in 1960 provokes a smile. Crawling on all fours among the theoretical bulletins laid out on the carpet of his hotel room, he found it by chance, and Tal employed it brilliantly. This story now sounds no less amateurish than the dialogue between Steinitz and Günzburg during the 12th game of their World Championship match of 1891. After playing the opening moves of an Evans gambit, Steinitz, with black, asked his opponent,
"Do you think that I am morally obliged to choose the same defence as in my match with Sigorin?"
"You are not obliged," replied Günzburg, "but the public expects that you will try to defend your theory."
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
The death of Tal in 1992 changed the entire tone of his life. From that time, Misha became one of the main topics of his letters. The maestro's words about my posthumous article on Tal, lively, sincere, warm, were more precious to me than any others. He himself began to prepare an article about Tal for New in Chess. I have thought about it very seriously. I want to show my intimate perception of Misha, the problem of giftedness, the prediction of it, the connection of a trainer with a gifted person, his ability to keep in the background, but simultaneously to have a positive influence. The world does not understand that. Apart from useful pieces of advice or the supplying of opening ideas, the most important thing that a trainer must do is to resolve the problem of his player's loneliness. Become a sincere friend, a therapist, as Misha in one interview half-jokingly called me. I want to dispel the myth of the Mozart-like easiness of his play and demonstrate his enormous efforts and bitter tears. I will cite chess material to confirm these psychological hypotheses. The only thing I have not decided is in what language to write, German or Russian. Something inside me inclines towards Russian, but I see your derisive but good-natured smile. I think that you will excuse my boldness in writing in Russian, believing me when I say that I do not consider myself a Pushkin, and, you know, frankly speaking, not even a Chekhov. Or from another letter, "At last, my final but global idea is taking shape. I have set up an international correspondence academy in Riga named after Mikhail Tal. The name of Tal will not be forgotten, and through it we will proclaim the beauty and depth of his play." In this remaining short period of his life, I began calling him Alec, not because maestro was Misha's expression and should have remained so, but rather because light-heartedness and frivolity had become somehow inappropriate and incorrect. This is from his very last letter. "The years pass, and ever closer is the prospect of the next life. True, in my memoirs there will be a chapter, a letter from the next world. This will be the most cheerful piece of the book." And at the very end, "With me, of course, it is a tragedy, So much material and so many thoughts have been gathered that they are bursting to come out. I am dying in an abyss of ever new welling ideas, but now I will finally stop and begin taking stock. The flood of ideas ceased on December 8, 1993, in Berlin. The stop was placed by death, and there was no one to take stock. I will nevertheless try. For two-thirds of his life, the maestro was a citizen of the USSR, probably the most artificial creation in recent history, which, despite its political groundlessness, or perhaps thanks to it, gave birth to more human types than any other country in Europe, with the exception perhaps of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the end of the 19th century. If, of course, one regards the Soviet Union as a completely European country. Who then was Alexander Koblenz? Despite the fact that he was born and lived his whole life in Riga and had a complete mastery of the Latvian language, he was not, of course, Latvian. Although in most of his life he spoke Russian and had a splendid knowledge of Russian literature and culture, it goes without saying that he was not Russian. Despite the fact that he went to a German school and spoke excellent German, and despite moving to Berlin for his very last years, he was not, of course, German. Jewish by birth, with a mother and sister who perished in the ghetto, he was also not totally Jewish, since questions of religion and questions associated with what is usually called national consciousness did not interest him. For the greater part of his life, the maestro lived in the Soviet Union. In order to function normally in that country, he had to wear a mask, as did many in those times. It was desirable not to remove it, even at night, in order not to be in constant conflict with yourself. In this case, it is true the mask could accrete with the face when it was already difficult to separate the one from the other. Koblenz's reminiscences of Tal, written for New in Chess, were full of Soviet terms, concepts, and names of people that were known only in the Soviet Union, to such an extent that the project had reluctantly to be rejected. Commentaries and footnotes would have exceeded the size of the article itself. I think that not every paragraph of his book devoted to the flourishing of chess in Soviet Latvia was written to conform to the rules of Soviet society. I also do not consider that the description of the first championship of the Latvian Soviet Republic, flooded with the light of the crystal chandeliers in the Hall of Mirrors of the former Riga Stock Exchange, is insincere, or that the words, "Chess is our republic," from being a hobby of lone people, is now being transformed into a genuinely mass game and will take an honourable place in the cultural life of the republic, with just an obligatory cliché. Finally, he could not have attained his social position and his name if Latvia had not been a Soviet republic. But for all that, the maestro was not and could not be a Soviet. Born a Baltic Jew in Riga, a city that has long stood at the intersection of different cultures, Latvian, German, Russian and Jewish, he was, of course, a cosmopolitan, a citizen of the world. But the maestro's cosmopolitanism was not only the result of a series of biographical accidents, it stemmed from his very nature. Despite the tragic events of the 20th century, which personally affected him and his family, despite a lengthy series of losses and difficult blows of fate, looking back on his life and adopting Aristotle's definition of happiness, to be able to exercise without hindrance one's abilities, whatever they be. One can say that the maestro lived a happy life and was able to retain the ideals of youth, an open disposition and cordiality. And yet, if we take stock, is there not too much in the negative balance? The chess club in the centre of Riga no longer exists, and its building, altogether in the spirit of the times, has been occupied by a bank. The magazine SARS, which started in Latvia in 1959, is no longer being published. The same fate has befallen the magazine in Berlin that Koblenz was the editor-in-chief of, and neither is there an academy named after Tal. His books, supplanted by numerous opening guides, are known only to connoisseurs. Koblenz himself had the bitter fate of outliving, even if not by long, his brilliant pupil. In his youth, between what was known in chess and what was not known, lay a broad field belonging to art and improvisation. It was for this part, strictly speaking, that Koblenz fell in love with chess. This field was full of mistakes, naive impressions and emotional delusions. It has now been reduced considerably, and the mistakes have gone, but the aura and the halo of the game itself have also largely gone. Man, armed with a computer, is close to solving the final truth in chess, but will it prove interesting? I am not at all sure that, if the graduate of the Riga German School again had to decide what career to choose in this modern era, he would again choose chess. And the last thing, what was it after all that drove him? What was it that wound up this spring which, in defiance of logic and common sense, did not allow him to rest? Which led him into chess, separating him from the measured tread of his father and subsequently also his son, who was so distant both from the game of chess and from his father's childlikeness and enthusiasm? Where is the explanation for this? In Moscow, towards the evening of a sultry July day in 1968, I was standing by the entrance to the Peking Hotel, where the trainers, seconds, and participants of the Tal-Korshnoi match were living. The previous day, the closing ceremony of the match had taken place, and later the feasting had gone on deep into the night. Unexpectedly, I saw the maestro heading in my direction. He looked at me critically, and did not respond as usual to my smile. "Well," he said, "you look great." I did indeed look rather baggy-eyed. "Would you like to know what is the meaning of life?" he suddenly asked. Dumbfounded by the question, I looked at him without replying. "I'll tell you," he continued. "You probably think in terms of pleasures, of parties. Is that what you think?" I continued saying nothing, since, to be honest, I did not even used to think about life, this jolly and more important, endless substance. "You are probably wondering, why is he so excited today? You are thinking, of course, will you manage to get to the football match today?" I lifted my head. The maestro had read my thoughts. I had never before seen him like this. "I'll tell you what. Creativity, that is what," he triumphantly stated. "Yes, creativity and everything else." He again looked me up and down. He himself had named the word, the impulse, the feeling that drove him all his life. This feeling is not given to everyone. Sometimes it disappears together with youth, and almost always it dries up by old age. That was not the case with the maestro. This feeling is, of course, a gift. He retained this gift in his restless genes until his death. The endless joy of creativity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. We thank our voice actor, Nick Murphy, our producer, Alex Pollock, and of course our sponsor, DGT, for their support, and hope to have you back soon for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.